I'm going to be talking about a project, a piece of a project that that I've been doing with a couple of different people. Not all of them are on the screen here, but we just want to highlight two folks who make special appearances in the presentation. One is Alexia Romero, who is a former undergraduate student of mine at Emory, who's now at the law school at Stanford. And the other is my colleague, George Vanberg. And so just to give you a sense, a kind of like theoretical model, that was joint work with George, and the empirical test of some of the implications of that model is with Alexia. Sort of don't purport to have the final say on exactly what explains compliance with Inter-American court decisions, but at the very least, what I want to suggest is the Inter-American setting provides a nice way of testing this theoretical argument that George and I did together. So to get going, let me just tell you a story. And the story is about, get this thing kind of facing me. The story is about Laura Alban. Begins with her, at least. It's a young woman in Ecuador who got sick, very, very seriously ill with meningitis. And she went to this hospital here in Quito, which is private, as it turns out. And she was in tremendous amount of pain. And so, to fix the pain, they treated her with morphine. The problem is that morphine is contraindicated with meningitis. Okay, so she died within just a couple hours. The parents, in the immediate aftermath of this event, started seeking simple pieces of information like the medical record, right? Who was the attending physician? None of this information was clear to them, and they were not given access to the file. So it took them about 2 years to even figure out this file. Once they found it and started figuring out what that had happened, they saw it in the criminal justice system, charges against these doctors for medical malpractice. After 10 years and a bunch of efforts to hold folks accountable, both at the hospital and in the justice system, the case kind of died domestically. At that point, they with assistance from NGOs, took the case to Washington, to the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, and issued a complaint that Ecuador had violated its international obligations under the American Convention. The commission ended up submitting that case to the Inter-American Court. Now, the Inter-American Court sits in San Jose, and it's the only court in the region under this system with jurisdiction to hear particular claims that states have violated their obligations. So the court found, just a few years ago, that Ecuador had violated two kinds of obligations. One had to do with its obligation to provide a prompt remedy, and the other was to provide a fair trial. So like any court in the world, when they find a violation of a right, there's going to be a remedy of some sort. So they issued a series of reparations. Here's what they asked Ecuador to do. They asked for money damages, okay, both for the parents and for Laura's siblings. They asked the state to publish the decision, and they asked for the dissemination of information on patient rights and to develop a program for justice officials on patients' rights. Okay, this is what they asked for. Now, this is what Ecuador implemented. Okay, they implemented the money damages, and they did absolutely nothing else in the time that the court gave them. So this would have been a year took them to not be able to publish the decision, for example. That's not all that strange, right? So what we know about, you know, sort of general compliance rates with Inter-American court decisions is reflected in the case. It's about 28%, according to this Hawkins and Jacoby study. In our case, right, it was 25%. And it actually turns out not to be that uncommon for other kinds of human rights international courts, like the European Court of Human Rights. So in particular cases, in particular as Europe's been expanding and the court's hearing cases from Russia and Turkey, they're starting to have significant non-compliance problems there as well. So here, 36% of these access to justice claims, they're getting compliance. So it's a considerable problem. Now, what I want to do is just say one thing here that we think we know, that is, when I say we, I mean sort of, you know, legal judicial scholars have a sense from what we know about compliance, that we've got a couple ideas here, right? Now, this is not a list of all the things we know. I bet if you know anything about compliance, you're thinking about maybe 7 or 8 things we think we also know. but I think this is salient because it raises a puzzle that I want to try to address. The first is international and domestic judges care about it, right? In fact, I was just in Costa Rica 2 weeks ago speaking to the president of the Costa Rican Constitutional Bench of the Supreme Court, who explicitly was talking about compliance monitoring because they're concerned about this issue that their decisions are not implemented, right? But that's not, I mean, this is just like a couple weeks ago, but we sort of know generally judges sort of care about this stuff. The second thing is that there's a decent amount of evidence that when courts are sort of like clear about what they want, right, they're more likely to get what they want. Yet, the remedies that courts issue, the rules that they construct are not always clear. They're often vague, right? The question is why. So let me give you a sample, a sense of how that looked in the Alban case. So consider the money damages order. So this is like an English translation of the money damages reparation. So this is going to look, should look pretty clear to you. They say, look, give them $25,000. Notice that they're not saying some amount of money. They issue it in a particular currency of a place, right? $25,000 to be paid to each victim. The state shall pay it directly to the beneficiaries, and they give a time limit, right? You got a year to do this. This is how they express the request for the program. The court also deems it necessary that within a reasonable time frame, the state implement an education training program for justice officers, or what's it say, operators, healthcare professionals, and laws enacted by Ecuador in relation to patients' rights. Okay, so we kind of know that there's supposed to be a program of a certain sort, right? As long as you know you can speak, hear, understand, read English, you kind of have a sense, right, of like what they're talking about from looking at this. But you don't know when, you don't know anything about the content, to whom it's supposed to be given, by whom, how many times, right? It's breadth. None of these things are actually stated, right? Compared to the money damages order, it's vague, at least. I would like to suggest that that's true. Okay. So what's in blue are what we coded as sort of relatively clear orders, and what's in red are the orders that were issued in this vague sense. And this is really common, right? It's not that they implement every clear order, but the vague orders in the Abam case were absolutely just ignored. Okay, so the research questions I'll be talking about for the rest of this presentation are, first, what explains varying state compliance with judicial orders? And again, I'm not going to try to explain all the variation, okay? I'm going to give you an argument that gives you a sense of what might, a particular tension judges have to construct, right? But generally, I'm aiming at this question of explaining state compliance with judicial orders. And the second, what explains the varying clarity of judicial orders? I wanted to suggest that these two questions are kind of linked together, precisely because judges confront a certain kind of problem that is kind of, particularly problematic for policymaking inside the judiciary. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to talk about the study with respect to the Inter-American Court, okay? But this study comes out of a general research project on compliance and compliance monitoring on international and domestic courts. This is the Inter-American piece. There's a piece on Costa Rica. There's another piece on Colombia. And what's, I think, kind of interesting about what we're seeing is these are instances, typically monitoring inside a legal system gets carried out through mechanisms of like fire alarms. That is, when there's a problem, litigants ring bells and they come to court, right? Here we've got judges actually going out and monitoring like police officers, okay? So in this talk, I'm sort of using that evidence to, or that process to get evidence of compliance, but a broader question has to do with, like, well, why exactly are they acting like police officers? Okay, and ultimately, this is just really about trying to answer this kind of question, which is essentially, under what conditions do we think the institutions that we construct to limit state authority actually do so in practice? Ultimately, at the end of the day, that's sort of big picture kind of question. Okay, so I'm going to do a theoretical model, some empirical tests, and some implications. That's the rest of it. So let me talk a bit about the model. So the model's, in practice, it's a little piece of game theory, but before I tell you about the particulars of it, let me just give you a sense of generally what's going on. All right, so the idea here is that varying doctrinal clarity, right, it's a manifestation of what I think of as a kind of fundamental problem of judicial policymaking, and that is judges don't implement the orders that they issue. They depend on other actors in the state to do that. That problem is never more acute than when they ask the people, when they're telling the element of the state to enforce an order on itself. Okay? So this is a big deal, I think, and I think vagueness has a lot to do with that kind of problem. Control over clarity or vagueness, if you want to think about it, addresses three kinds of issues. So the first one, I'm saying manage here, you want to think about manage, like they sort of have to deal with a certain kind of problem. The problem they have to deal with is the link between the instruments that they issue, which is like money damages, okay, or give someone a lawyer, right, or provide a program of training of some sort, and the outcome that they want. Those are not the same things, right? You might want justice, but you can't order justice. You order pay someone damages, right? And then in not every case is there a direct and easy link between the instrument and the outcome. And so what vagueness does in a certain sense, like it does for legislatures when they're talking to bureaucracies, it allows the implementer a little bit of discretion into how to get from point A to point B. It allows this implementer to inform, right? How do you do the patient's right program right? Well, we'll ask Ecuadorians to do it for us. You fill in the blanks, okay? Takes advantage of the information. They know who the best teachers are, for example. Right? You want to order clean water in a community. You know who the best folks are to handle that problem. The problem is the second bullet point. Once you do that, right? Once you're vague, you've incentivized noncompliance because it's hard to tell what it would mean to have implemented the decision. Okay? So there's a trade-off. The third thing that vagueness deals with, and you know, I'm currently kind of sort of agnostic about whether this is exactly right or not, but we've built it into the argument, and that is sometimes judges really just don't want to have people observe them being defied. Right? Okay, and if you ask judges about this, some will say they care about it, some will say they don't. But so what vagueness can do is sort of hide noncompliance. So if you can put yourselves in the U.S. context, you bring the classic example is the second Brown decision, right? And so you're asking them to implement desegregation with all deliberate speed, right? And so had they said do it tomorrow, right, everywhere in the following kind of way, it's not clear at all that people would have done it, right? So one thing that vagueness does is prevent you from being observed being defied. So we're going to allow for that kind of problem to be addressed. Okay? I should mention, too, at any point, if you just have a question, clarifying or otherwise, whatever kind of question, please raise your hand. I don't know what your rules are here, but I'm totally happy if you want to derail this talk, that's okay, too. Please ask some questions, okay? If something's vague. So the game theory model is designed to kind of deal with, sort of address a piece of this, or at least model this tension. And the whole idea here is it's a spatial model, okay? So we're on the number line, right? And what the judge is going to do is say, give me a policy, okay? And that's a point in the number line. And then the policy implementer, right, the agency or the legislature, whomever, the president, whoever it is going to pick a point on the line. Okay, and then after they pick that point, that's going to get translated into a policy outcome. Right, so technically, the court's going to pick this little p, which is a number. Right, specifically, they're going to pick zero. All right, and we can talk about like why we say zero. What they can vary is how clearly they say zero. Okay, so A there, that parameterizes like how clear they're trying to be. So if A is really close to one, that's like do zero, very clearly. Right. A is getting closer to zero, it's a little bit unclear as to whether I said zero or something else. Okay. Then the official is going to implement the thing. Okay. And then importantly, if political scientists that are in the room maybe tell me I'm wrong on this, but this is like reflected in kind of the way that we model legislative and bureaucratic interactions. So X here is a policy outcome, and it's a function of the policy that you implement and some error. Right? So the error is going to be drawn from a uniform distribution on the interval, alpha, negative alpha. What does that mean? Well, alpha is just like, how uncertain are you about the link between the policy and the outcome, right? So if alpha were darn close to zero, then you'd know you'd be pulling epsilons from a basically something right around zero, and so the policy outcome is just whatever they implement. But if alpha is really big, it could be that the policy outcome is like P minus some huge number. Okay, so here's what they know and what they care about, right? So the policymaker is the only one that sees the actual draw of the epsilon. They both know that there's a distribution, that you're going to get this epsilon, but only the policymaker sees it, so they have better information. This is like modeling the point that you just give discretion or vagueness to take advantage of informational advantages that implementers have. Both players are going to want, or these actors here are going to want to minimize the distance between the policy outcome and what they really most prefer. So for the court, what they really like is zero, right? And then we're going to have this policymaker like things at like L. That's because George Vanberg thinks about legislatures, and I'm mostly dealing with bureaucrats. But that's what L is. It's the ideal point of the legislature or the policy implementer. All right, so some specific issues here. The policymaker pays costs for defining orders, and the marginal cost is going to depend on how clear the court is, right? So if I say zero and you stick a policy out at 39, right, but I said zero with very low clarity, it doesn't really bother me. I've got the 39 or 70 or a million without paying costs. But if you say, right, give me zero and you're really clear, the further I get out, the worse it hurts me, right? Okay. And it's also going to be the costs are also going to be marginally influenced by what we're thinking of as public support. That's the primary enforcement mechanism for all these judicial decisions. That is, there are political costs for defying a court, which can be big or small. The court also pays costs for being defied. The marginal cost is also going to depend on clarity. That picks up that idea that they might like to not have people see they're being defied, right? So if they're really clear and they say, give me zero, and the legislature's way out there, that's harmful, right? But if they're vague, it doesn't matter what they say, right? Okay, and then finally, the court is going to place a weight on the institutional consequences of noncompliance, which is just to say, each kind of court in this model could basically say, well, I don't really care about whether people actually defy me and people know it. I'm not interested in that. I only care about the policy outcome. Or you can have a court that says, in addition to the policy outcome, I really don't want to have people see that I'm not very powerful. All right, so we just parameterize that. So we can consider what would you get at different kinds of courts. All right, so that's the payoff functions. Basically, I can come back and talk about this if you'd like. But these equations, right, these functions just basically do everything I'm saying in words. This is the court, and that's just the policy loss. That's the loss for being defied. This is the policymaker. That's the policy outcome loss, and that's the loss for failing to comply. Okay, so the results. Here's what the policymaker does in equilibrium, right? They issue this policy, P star, this fraction, and it's got some pretty intuitive properties, okay? So all it says is, the further I am from zero, the further the policy is that I'm going to implement, okay? No shock there. And the bigger the shock is, the further away from zero I'm going to go. Why? Well, the bigger the shock is, I need to absorb that, right? So I'm going to go further away from what the court asked for. And then the most important thing is, notice that like that A thing is in the denominator. So that's how clear they are. Okay? And so what that's telling you is, right, the clearer the court is, the closer the court can pull the legislature back towards zero. Right? If you think about like what if you set A equals zero, then that would mean that the policy they implement is equal to L plus epsilon over 1. That just means the legislature gets exactly what it wants. Right? It absorbs the shock. Right, and it gets exactly its ideal. So when the court is totally vague, they're just giving over discretion, whatever the state wants to do. All right, so this is what the court does. I'm going to show this visually, but I just want to make a point. Let's ignore this thing down here if you want to. But the court does three simple kinds of things. So this is the clarity with which they're going to issue the decision. There's three kinds. There's the totally vague, right? That's zero. And that's if the legislature or the policymaker is really close to you. So if you got a legislature kind of close, you should just be vague because you really want this person to use the information they have to get you what they want. So you just give them whatever they want. Well, whatever they want is close enough to you, so it's fine. If they're really far, you should be totally clear to pull them as close as you can to you. Okay? And if there's certain some middle range, then you give some order that's somewhere between clear and vague, and that's what that equation is here. So this is what this looks like visually. It's probably a little bit easier. I don't know if this is easier. I mean, another way of looking at the results. The x-axis here is how far away from the court, that would be where the court is the legislature or the policy implementer. That's this. And then the y-axis is how much do they care about being defied, right? That's that C parameter, that thing that says, oh, do I worry about people paying attention and noticing that I'm not powerful? So what you see is a couple things. So first is, if you make that thing really big, then courts are always vague. Notice this region here is a region where courts are always vague. So for a sufficiently high institutional concern, they just don't say anything clear. But once once they're not totally concerned with that, then some other interesting things happen. So this region here, this is where they're intermediately clear, and this is where they're totally clear. So a couple things. First is they should be more clear the further away from them the state is, or the policy implementer is. And the second thing is, see these little alphas here? Those are those parameters about how uncertain I am. Well, as they get bigger, this region here shifts out. And there's a region where they're less than clear. So what that's telling you is the more uncertain they are about the link between the instrument and the outcome, the more vague they should be. That gives us some empirical implications, and that's all the game theory I'm going to do. Please let me know if you want me to go back at any point or never talk about it again.
It's fine.
So first empirical implication is...
Did you work out the proof?
Yeah. You want me to do it now? Man, that thing is nasty. I don't think I can do that. I need a computer for that. So for sufficiently low institutional concerns, right, for C low enough, then clarity should increase as uncertainty about the connection between means and ends gets smaller, right? When you know how to fix the problem, you should be more clear, okay? And as policy differences decrease. And then the second thing, right, the compliance stuff, we should see increasing compliance as the clarity of the order increases, as the policy differences decrease, and the public costs of defiance increase, okay? So let's talk about the real world for a minute. Why the Inter-American Court? Well, it's actually kind of a really nice case for testing that kind of implication for a couple different reasons. One, the orders, so as a legal matter, the orders that the court issues in the cases that we're looking at, so this is the case that come under its contentious jurisdiction, these are cases that are legally binding on states that have accepted their jurisdiction. So as a principled matter, when they say something, the state should implement it, okay? The other thing is that these are very detailed kinds of orders that are they're not issuing general rule. Well, that's not entirely true. How do I put this? So this isn't like the U.S. Supreme Court just saying to the rest of the federal judiciary, get the rule right in some way, and then remanding it to the rest of the judiciary or to some circuit court for further proceedings. They're giving direct orders to a particular state. Okay. And the second thing that's really nice is that they have this really nice, detailed, very detailed monitoring mechanism for their own decisions, right? So how are you going to get data on compliance? Well, one nice thing about the Inter-American system is they have it for you. In fact, if you want, you can go pull it down on the web to the Inter-American Court and go to this case, and then you can pull down on PDF, or if you like Word, you can pull down that thing. And each one of these documents is going to provide an extremely detailed account of, like, what happened to each of the orders after they issue them. Okay. So the last question we have to ask before we talk about the empirics is, well, wait a second. What is the C value for the Inter-American Court? That is, how much do they care about being observed being defied? Okay. And I can't measure that. And when we thought about modeling this thing, we thought that was like a property of a court. Certainly, you could imagine it varying over time. But in this study, we have a small number of years. It would be weird if the court was massively varying with respect to that issue over time. And our sense is that, at least mine, Alexia's, is it's pretty small or it's low enough for us to see something more than they should always be vague. Okay? And there's a couple reasons for that. One is, like, you know, this court was born in the late 70s in a period of, like, really horrible, as you all know in this audience, right, military dictatorships in the region filled with terrible human rights violations. And nobody, when it was first founded, thought that their orders would actually be implemented, right? And so there's just like a, that's kind of like not the point of this court necessarily. That is, they're used to being defied, okay? That can't be that bad at this point. I mean, there's a history of people ignore a lot of their orders. And the second thing is just an empirical matter. 70% of their orders are clear. Right? So one or two things about that. Either that just falsifies the model. We're actually up there, and that evidence is totally inconsistent with it. Or, I mean, come on, this is probably a court that is not totally hung up with every little instance of noncompliance. So here's what the cases look like. There are 292 remedies, or reparations, coming from 45 different cases between 2005 and 2009. Those are the countries from which they come from. As you can tell, Colombia has a bunch. Where's Peru? They have a bunch as well. But most of the members that have given jurisdiction this court are represented in the data set. So how do we measure compliance? Right? So we do it two ways. One is the court itself in those reports has a binary indicator of compliance. And they ask, has the state provided the reparation that we ordered? And then they say yes or no. So we use that. Right? It's whatever the court thinks is true. And then we have a coder-derived binary indicator of like what I think of as resistance. Okay, so the problem here is that sometimes, like within the year, the state doesn't implement the decision. In the next year, right, it doesn't. Eventually, it does. And so the court says there was compliance, but it wasn't exactly like they dragged their feet. Okay, so we want to pick that up. So there's the second measure. I can talk about the results with both of these if you're interested. How do we measure clarity? We do it with human beings. One approach would be to cram this into a computer and try to draw out some computer-derived sense of clarity. We actually we asked two coders who were not familiar with the project's tools to look at the reparations and just say, A, does this look clear to you? Is what is required in the state unambiguous? Or is it vague? Okay, does the remedy leave considerable discretion in the state? We had an intermediate category, which was, what is it called? Somewhat clear. The thing is that just didn't discriminate at all. In fact, somewhat clear sort of functions like clear as an empirical matter. So we ended up binning that into a dichotomy. Obviously, not ideal because there probably are some intermediary categories. This is what we're going to hit the data with first. So just give you a sense of what the data look like. in some ways, you don't need a lot more than a crosstab in quantitative research all that often, and I think this is a good case. Before you get crazy with like statistical modeling, like what do the data look like? And here they tell an interesting story. So if you think about this far right column, this is just the instances of noncompliance, and you'll notice that it was about 60%, that's what's in parentheses, when they're clear, and it jumps up to 86% when they're vague. We already knew that there's lots of noncompliance, right? But when they're vague, it gets really high. We also, so this is just the same thing with resistance, and this number is really striking, right? Like, darn near 100%, not all of them, right? There's three cases where they were vague, where there wasn't some form of resistance, okay? So there, it seems to me, just in the crosstab, there's some sense that something might be going on here. We also coded for something we call, like, massive resistance, that is, over repeated efforts to get the state to implement the decision, they refused. And this is what that crosstab looks like. So actually, there's only 44% of the cases where they were clear about what they wanted was there this form of massive resistance, but that jumps up to almost 80% of everything. Okay. So the last sort of empirical piece, I should say, that I'm going to talk to you, but just in terms of measurement, is how do you measure alpha? That is, how certain the court would be about the connection between the policy they asked for and what the outcome's going to be. Okay. And so this we didn't do with the coders. This we did ourselves. And so we have two approaches. One is to do this. To say, like, okay, well, what kind of policy should be easy to handle? Okay? And money damages are one of them. That is, it is not hard to get you to transfer money to you. Right? I'm not uncertain about what's going to happen if I just give a bank account number and a bank account number and turn the crank. That should be really simple. Same with, like, publicizing a decision. Or publishing a decision, right? Like, if you know the name of the newspaper, just give the name of the newspaper and tell them to do it. That's very different from investigating a crime. Why? Especially in this context. You don't know if you're clear, right? Who's going to do the investigating? You could be asking for the very agency that, like, committed the crimes, right? Same with, like, a lot of form of equitable relief, like providing clean water. I mean, how is a judge supposed to know exactly how to do that? That's a situation where they're going to be, in our view, a little bit more uncertain about the links. Okay. So we've got a couple other things that we're going to measure. One is preference divergence. So how do we do that? Unfortunately, it would be great to do this with respect to each remedy, right? But here, we're doing it with respect to the state. So what we're asking is, what's the state's general human rights record look like? Okay, the idea being, if it's worse, they're further away from the Inter-American Court of Human Rights. So when they're talking to Guatemala, it's actually very different from when they're talking to Costa Rica. That's the logic of that idea. Okay. And then cost of defiance. Unfortunately, we wanted like a survey item that picked up like public support for the Inter-American Court, and we couldn't find that. So what we've got is something that I don't like, but it's here. And that is from the Latino Barometer. We can look at average trust in the domestic judiciary, right? Okay. Which we thought maybe was correlated with support for the international court. It turns out that's probably not true. Okay, so a couple possible confounders that we're going to control for. One is bureaucratic quality. That is, how good is the bureaucracy in your state, right? Because it's possible that better bureaucracies implement orders better, and your human rights record may be better if you got a better bureaucracy, okay? And then we have a measure of latent judicial independence, which I can talk to you about if you're interested. The idea here is Hillebrecht has argued that what's going on in these cases is that, like, courts are, states are signaling to the international community that they respect human rights by implementing these orders. And you can only do that credibly when you're constrained inside your own country, okay? And one of the institutions that constrains a state is like an independent judiciary, right? So you should expect more compliance with this independent judiciary and better human rights records. So that's what we got. Okay, so the empirical model, we've got 292 remedies. They're nested inside 45 cases, and those are nested within 17 states. So we've got this two-equation model we're going to estimate. The only thing I'd highlight here, this is the model for the clarity. This is the model for compliance.
Sorry, quick question.
Yeah, go ahead.
Silly question.
No,
remedy means what they have to actually do, right?
What's that?
Remedy means what they have to do. Okay.
Yeah, remedy, reparation, right. I use interchangeably. Good, yeah.
Okay.
So the only thing here is that, just a note, we've got like these little symbols. This is just like a random intercept for the case. So some cases are going to be worse than others, and some states are worse than others for both equations. So cases and states. Okay. All right. So what the results look like, let me just show you some probabilities. So this is just coming out of the model. So what's the probability of a clear order when you're uncertain, right? It's actually about 40%, right? What about when you're certain? Well, that jumps up to 90. Okay, so it's a pretty big impact of this certainty difference, right? And then in terms of compliance, right, when you're vague, the probability of compliance is actually down around 0.2, and when you're clear, it's around 0.5. Okay, so again, big sort of impacts, I think, in these figures. This is the Human Rights Index results. So we should see this is bad, this is good. So compliance should go up, right, the better you get, and you do. But notice, like, these are the error bars around these predictions, and they're pretty big. So there's some uncertainty about these predictions. But the estimated effect is actually pretty big, going from about 0.35 on one end to 0.556 or something on the other. And then last thing I'll talk about here is just the bureaucracy, because I think actually as we move into the other parts of the project, that the bureaucracy is actually pretty key. And so we've got, again, the state level, just general measure of bureaucratic quality. We go from, you know, probability of compliance at about 0.2 to almost 3/4 when it's really, really good. Last thing I'll show you here, let me just skip that, and let's talk about some of the implications. Given the time. Just to summarize here, the court seems to be a little bit less clear when the solution to the policy challenge is not obvious, and states do seem to be a little bit less likely to comply when they're vague. There's some evidence, I think, that bureaucratic quality may be pretty important to at least the compliance piece of the puzzle. And there's some mixed evidence for the human rights record. I mean, again, it's trending upward, but there's a lot of uncertainty. There's really no evidence for a domestic judicial trust, and it turned out there was no evidence for this independent judiciary issue. So let me just say something about what I think we might want to ask in light of the results here. The first question is kind of like a typical judicial politics question. There's, and to some extent, a typical IR question, right? You want to ask, well, is the Inter-American Court fundamentally constrained by political realities? That is, could it ever constrain governments of the system? Or is it itself constrained and therefore not able to actually hold states to their commitments? And the answer to that is yes and no. I mean, to some extent, it has some authority, right? So it can increase compliance. The problem is, in certain cases, it doesn't, by being clear. But in some cases, it might not want to be clear. That is, the very thing it could do to actually ramp up compliance may be quite bad for it. Right, it may risk right a worse outcome than if they're vague. So there's a bit of a trap. Okay. The second issue has to do with pragmatism. So what's in red is a quote from a former well, the whole thing's a quote. I just want to focus on the red bit from a former judge of the court, and he's really talking about the role of pragmatism. He's completely opposed to it, right? And he's arguing here that there's really no room for pragmatism under the American Convention. And I guess I just totally disagree with that. And I disagree with it because, you know, decision-making, because they don't implement their orders, that process is inherently interdependent. Right? Because that's true, they kind of have to be pragmatic. Right? They have to take it. They don't have to, I suppose. If they don't care about policy outcomes at all, I think they can choose not to be pragmatic. But if they care about policy outcomes, they have to think about the policy-making process. And that raises a question about how to train pragmatic judges. The final thing I'll say is just to ask some open questions. First, I mean, is this just a problem with international courts, or is this something about domestic courts? Second, one thing that we're not looking at in this particular study, which I think is very cool, this is an idea that Cesar Rodriguez calls dialogic activism, right? So the idea here is, like, what you do as a court is you don't immediately start off by being super clear. You start off by being kind of vague, and then you follow up. Right? And you see what they've done. And then you get more clear and more clear over time. Okay? And that's how you get these states to comply. Right? I think that's a very interesting idea. It may be right. We'd have to observe that that's actually right. Right? We don't want to observe that all they do is they keep following up and they never do it. Okay? And then finally, we can ask questions about what the effect is of police patrol monitoring. Something I haven't talked about here is the Inter-American Court sometimes has these hearings, all right, throughout the process. Some of the hearings are private. Some they open to the public and the press. Right? So we can start asking questions about, is there a difference between their compliance impact when they open it up to the media? I get that I said a bunch of stuff in a small amount of time, and I'm happy to clarify really what I've said and answer any questions that you have. Thanks a lot for your time.